You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Years ago, when I was a teenager, I used to be afraid to go sit out on the lawn or go out on a picnic on the grass with my friends because I knew I'd have to pay for it later in the day. Literally, after sitting out on the grass, I'd wind up have a terrible wheeze, a bit of asthma later that night. And I even took allergy shots to combat my allergic reactions to grasses, pollens, and weeds as it was diagnosed, but they didn't really seem to do much good. Then, you know, something weird happened. In my late 20s, as if by magic, my allergies started to go away. I mean, they started to disappear on their own. They lessened each year until today I rarely experience any kind of allergic reaction. But I bring this up now because we're in the teeth of the spring allergy season, and I know this because I hear from so many of my friends and colleagues telling me how terrible they are suffering. They've got the stuffed sinuses, the runny nose, the itchy eyes, even in the desert of Arizona. So we thought we'd talk today about allergies and see if we can bring us all up to date on the many questions, the many myths circulating among us, like, how should I take bee pollen? Things like that. Well, we'll try to get into all of these things. We'll talk about why allergies may suddenly appear, may suddenly disappear, like in my case. Why do some allergy drugs lose their effects after a year? Lots of questions for my guest. If you'd like to join in and ask anything you'd like to know about allergies, our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. Also, you can Twitter us. We'll take your tweets at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and also in Second Life. Folks are gathered around there, and we'd be happy to hear from you. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Kalman Prussin is chief of the lymphocyte biology section of the Laboratory of Allergic Diseases, and he's at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and that's part of NIH in Bethesda. You knew that. He joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Prussin.
Great to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Dr. Michael Kalliner is a professor of medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine. He's also medical director of the Institute for Allergy, for Asthma and Allergy in Chevy Chase, and he has consulted and lectured for a number of different pharmaceutical companies, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Thank you for being with us today. Let me ask you first, Dr. Prussin, is this an unusual allergy season, or, you know, why is it strike you that way?
Well, every allergy season is an unusual one if you have allergies, in the sense that, but they do, some are worse than others because of the weather, whether it's, a milder winter, you can get more germination of various flowers. Increased pollen. If it's very windy, you'll have higher pollen mm-hmm. levels. So every season is unique. Mm-hmm. I haven't perceived it in my own experience in terms of what I've heard, but different localities, different parts of the country may experience it different as well.
Dr. Kalliner, your experience this year?
Well, as Cal said, every year is terrible. What I actually tell patients is that this is the worst year ever.
Every year.
Every year.
Every year. It's the worst.
But in reality, this year, which started early-ish because we had a fairly mild winter, has not been unusual at all in the pollen counts. And so patients just forget from year to year how terrible it is.
Mm-hmm. And you can actually go online and see the pollen counts in different cities around the country.
That's right.
And what do they tell you? I mean, are they really useful, or are they just a scorecard for keeping score?
They tell you what's in the air. So that, for example, I'll just give you our own level of ignorance. When we first set up our practice, we did not recognize that an evergreen called cedar was in the Washington, D.C. area. We just didn't know it was here. Mm-hmm. And when we started looking at pollen counts, lo and behold, in February and March, patients were complaining of symptoms. And the only thing in the air, the absolute only thing in the air, was red cedar. And so we started skin testing the red cedar, and lo and behold, that's what caused their symptoms. So it allowed us to identify an important allergen of which we were unaware.
We're going to have a little bit later in the program, Dr. Jay Portnoy is going to come on to talk about the pollen counts and how to deal with them. But let's talk about what happens in your body when you're allergic to something, Dr. Kalliner. What happens when pollen enters an allergy sufferer's nose? Walk us through the reaction that goes on there.
Well, a pollen grain is the male gamete. It's the sperm equivalent from a plant. So it's out looking for a female plant like all of us guys do. And when it gets into the nose, it honestly can't distinguish the nose from a female plant. And so on the surface of the pollen grain are water-soluble enzymes that come off the surface and act as if it was trying to open up the channel for which the gamete can get to the female plant and impregnate it. And those water-soluble enzymes are largely the allergens to which we are allergic. So you know, what happens is the plant is, by mistake, on our nose and gets us exposed to that allergen. And you have to be then genetically predisposed to recognize the allergen. So only about 40% of the people in the United States are genetically capable of seeing that allergen and then responding to it by making an immune response. The other 60% don't even see it. They don't recognize it as anything, and it's totally invisible. But for those of us like you and I, and Cal, we see the pollen grain enzyme, and we make a specific immune response to it, and that involves the creation of a new antibody called IgE. That IgE takes about anywhere from 2 to 10 years to get to the level where you become sensitized. So you have to be exposed and exposed and exposed, and then you make enough IgE antibody to become sensitive to the pollen, and then the next time you're exposed to it, that antibody is sitting on the surface of a cell that contains histamine, and the histamine is released from the cell and causes the allergic reaction, which makes us sneeze, wheeze, and itch.
So that's why it could take years to develop an allergy?
That's right. So people come and they say, I can't be allergic to my dog. I've had this dog for five years. And we say, that's perfect.
That's how long it took.
Right.
Dr. Prussin, what is the immune system trying to do in these cases?
Well, to the best of the types of immune responses you make to allergens are very similar to the immune responses we make to parasites, to worm parasites. Mm-hmm. And to our best understanding, it's essentially a mistake that the immune system is making. These pollens, animal danders, they're not dangerous. They're not going to hurt us. So our immune system should ignore them. But it's somehow miscued, and instead it's making a what we call a Th2 type of immune response, this IgE immune response, mm-hmm. Thinking it's attacking a parasite possibly.
Well, my question about all of this is something I've been wondering for years. If our bodies are used to seeing these over the years, why don't they get better at fighting them off? Or are they fighting them off, and that's the problem?
You're exactly right. So they think they're fighting them off by making every year, often a better immune response. And so in the first few years, let's say somebody, for example, we have postdoctoral students from other countries. They come to the United States without any allergies. And then after a year or two, they start having symptoms. And every year, first year it's not so bad, next year it's a little worse. So as your immune system builds up more immunity, think of like a vaccine. You get a few, every time you get it, you get more and more immunity. Mm-hmm. You get a better immune response and more inflammation, more itching, more wheezing and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And that's what happens with all kinds of allergens, including bee stings, things like that.
Well, to some degree, but then if you get enough of it, sometimes you actually circumvent those mechanisms and you get, for example, with bee stings, tolerance. So beekeepers typically are not allergic, and they actually have a specific type of immune response which gives them tolerance so that they don't have anaphylaxis, a sort of a whole-body allergic reaction to the bee sting.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, you know, it's different from vaccination where you give us a little bit of the a weakened form of, let's say, a polio virus or a dead form, and that gives us an immunity. The same thing is not happening here.
That's the treatment, Ira. That's what allergy shots are.
Yeah. I took allergy shots for many years, and I don't think they did anything. I don't know. Well, explain to me why I grew out of it, so to speak.
You were lucky.
I was lucky.
It's good genes, Ira.
All right. I'll take that as a good answer. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Pete from Flagstaff. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
I have a question for the doctor. I want to see what his opinion was on neti pots for flushing the nasal cavity of any pollens or allergens that might get trapped up in there.
Yeah, using the saline solution, right?
Sodium bicarbonate, I think they use in that.
Yeah, does that work, doctors?
Well, it's great. And we have, I would say that I put 100% of my patients on some sort of a nasal washing system. Sometimes the neti pot, sometimes just the spray, and sometimes something we call sinus rinse, which is a way to irrigate the sinuses. But I think that many of the people come back and say that the neti pot is more effective than anything else we use. And so my bottom line is to get patients better, and if that works, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. That's great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Do the over the?
I would agree with that. The one problem is about half of patients just don't like sticking things into their nose. So that's the downside of that. But I think it's effective, and for a lot of mild symptoms, works well.
Mm-hmm. Are over the counter drugs as good antihistamines as stuff that you get by prescription?
Remember, every over the counter drug was a prescription product and had to prove itself safe and effective before they let it go over the counter. Mm-hmm. And so today's over-the-counter drugs were yesterday's prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. So you know, what we have available over the counter, if it works for the patients, Claritin, Zyrtec, and all the, we got 20 older antihistamines that are very inexpensive and still quite good, are fine. We have prescription products that have maybe some advantages, but the bottom line is that antihistamines are antihistamines.
And that's that last process in the process we talked about, the histamine being released.
Histamine is one of many mediators, and Cal can talk about that because that's part of his research. But there are many other chemicals released in addition to histamine that cause the intense reaction that we call allergy.
Cal, you want to describe that?
Well, there's different parts of the immune system, and so one of the parts that I study are the role of T cells. So the same cells that are important in terms of fighting infectious disease that are knocked out by AIDS turn out to be some of the mischief makers in terms of allergic disease, sort of telling, sort of directing IgE production, telling cells to make IgE and causing inflammation locally. So obviously an antihistamine only blocks one of those mediators, and it may be that other diseases such as, for example, asthma is not well treated with antihistamines, but other agents for the future that might be better at blocking these other mediators, these other interleukin-4, things like that.
Is there lots of research going on to create the drugs for the symptoms but to actually stop the allergic reaction from happening?
Very much so. So what at the NIH-funded research, other funded research in other countries is largely directed at trying to understand trying to use what we've learned in the last 20 years in terms of the general immune system and try to apply that to allergic disease. Mm-hmm. And the reason is not so we know more only, but so that we can then, once we know more, we can develop better treatments, better ways to avoid these, better mm-hmm. management strategies.
Because if I'm the chairman of a board of a drug company that makes the remedies, I don't want a cure for this. I want to treat it forever. You know, why lose a patient? I can sell all those over-the-counters and prescription drugs for the remedy,
Ira, you know, you've done this show for a long time. You know there are very, very, very few diseases that are ever cured.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
And this one is not very harmful either.
Well, it's extremely bothersome to the patient. So if you know what a quality of life measurement is?
Tell me.
Okay, so it's a way that we can assess in a number of domains how much bother a disease is to the patient. So it ranges from everything that a patient feels about his life. Then it's divided into seven domains. And when patients are asked their quality of life from hay fever, that bothersome nose, it is more bothersome to most patients than cancer and heart disease. So it may not be an important disease mm-hmm. in terms of dying, but it's an extremely important disease for quality of life. And in fact, more money is spent on rhinitis and the treatment of rhinitis than most any other disease that we take care of because mm-hmm. people don't want to have sneezing, itching, and runny nose all the time.
Talking about allergies this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if I can get a quick question in from Miami. Terry, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, hi. I am interested in the doctor's response to certain alternative techniques that I've actually found very effective in treating allergies, neuromodulation technique and NAET that we've used in my family to actually get rid of both allergies to pollen pollen and different things like that, as well as food allergies and pet allergies. We've had really good luck with that in our family.
All right, let me see if I can get a question for an answer for you. Doctors, are you familiar with
that? The NIH has an institute, the National Center of Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and they are trying to address some of these agents and these approaches. I should add that what Mike had just talked about, the neti pot and the saline, is one of the ultimate in terms of holistic or alternative therapies. But as a scientist and as a physician scientist, I think it's important that we that we have an approach that uses a controlled clinical trial to understand these. And the reason is that, for example, asthma, when you treat asthma with a placebo, 50, 60, 70% of the patients improve. And so these diseases are very difficult to study without those types of placebo-controlled studies. So it's not that these techniques don't work necessarily, but we'd all like to see them studied in random, double-blind placebo-controlled studies.
One of the stories about asthma over the years is that it's possibly emotionally linked. Is there any truth to that?
Well, there's always stress and emotions have influences on how you feel in many body responses, including asthma and allergies. But in terms of the causation, there are factors that make them worse, but they don't cause the disease.
Mm-hmm. A question from Second Life from Laura Gino is local honey from local pollen useful for allergies? We've heard a lot about the bee honey.
It's sweet.
It's sweet. What about bee pollen?
Well, so getting to the relationship of bees and pollen and things like that, bees pick up pollen when they're getting the nectar from the plants to make the honey. And the pollen itself, if you eat that pollen and you're allergic to it, you can have a severe reaction to it. So there was some homeopathic approach where some people tried to use bee pollen as a treatment for allergic disease, and some patients got quite sick and nearly died. So that's dangerous. But the honey itself has no pollen allergen in it, so it's safe, it's sweet, and I would recommend it for sweetening, but not to treat your disease.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Dr. Calvin Prussen of NIH and Dr. Michael Kalliner, who's at George Washington University School of Medicine. 1-800-989-8255. We'll talk a little bit more about that and also talk about pollen counting and tracking pollen and mold and all these allergens that are flying and buzzing and all around us. And why is pollen from grass different from pollen from flowers? Interesting difference. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about allergy seasons with my guest, Dr. Calvin Prussen, Dr. Michael Kalliner. And my next guest has been tracking pollen and mold for the last 15 years. And he's here to talk about the pollen count. You know, if you look at the news every night or maybe in the mornings on the local newscast, you see this little graph. It shows you what the pollen and mold count is like. It's a color-coded sort of thing with different levels of pollen grains and mold spores and things like that. Here to explain it is Dr. Jay Portnoy. He's the immediate past president of the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. He's also chief of the section of allergy, asthma, and immunology at Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Portnoy.
Thanks for having me on, Ira.
You're welcome. Is there somebody actually going out there and counting every grain of pollen?
Yeah, actually, that's exactly right. First, I wanted to say that I listen to your show every week. It's my favorite show, and I just love the way you do things. So it's really a thrill to be on.
Thank you.
We've been doing the pollen count for Kansas City for the last 15 years, and most people don't know how that count is actually done. What we have is a machine on the roof of our hospital that collects the air at a steady flow, and it collects the air through a very narrow slit onto an adhesive-coated microscope slide. What happens is that the air flows around the slide and the particles impact on it because they have inertia. And so every 24 hours, somebody goes up to the roof, replaces the old slide with the new slide, and then we take it down to the laboratory where we have microscopists who stain the slide and then look at it and physically count the pollen grains one by one.
And you can tell, and you do announce, the different kinds of pollen from what the sources.
That's right, because each of the pollen grains has a very characteristic appearance. And in fact, it's absolutely fascinating to take a look at these pollen grains. They have a variety of features on them that increase their aerodynamic buoyancy so that they can travel long distances from one plant to another. Some of them look like golf balls, which in fact is one of the ways that we got the idea for shaping golf balls to look like that from pollens. Others have little air bladders on the side that keep them in the air, and you know they do a variety of different things. And by knowing what the pollens look like, our trained microscopists can then identify each one, tally them up, and then report it out as a count every day.
Now, the show's on the road in Arizona a couple of weeks ago, and people from the east were saying, boy, my allergies are really acting up out here in the desert. You know, we don't think of the desert.
Great Ira, we love it. As an allergist, it's job security for us. But really, no matter where you go, there's always something in the air that people can make an immune response to. In the desert, there's more Bermuda grass pollen and olive trees. In the Midwest, we have just regular deciduous tree pollens that starts in February, goes through April. It's a whole series of little mini seasons because each species of tree pollinates for about 1 or 2 weeks. Grass season is May and June. Think of June grass. It's like one giant 6-week allergy season. Everybody's just miserable. And then in July, the pollen drops off again, and most allergists go on vacation. So we're well taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
August 15th is the first day of the ragweed season in Kansas City. We have a little celebration. You're welcome to join us someday if you'd like. It peaks on September 10th, right after Labor Day, and usually by early October, the pollen count for ragweed drops off again.
No ragweed, no thank you. When I see ragweed, I feel like I'm Dracula looking at a spike, you know, so
I look some garlic. Pollen grains look like, too. They have these little spikes on them. And by the way, you know, we've been doing the pollen count for the last 15 years, and what we've found is that the tree pollen pollinates about 2 to 3 weeks earlier now than it did 15 years ago, and the ragweed is lasting 2 to 3 weeks longer now. We attribute a lot of that to climate change. So, you know, global warming is having an effect on allergies.
Interesting. Is the pollen that we get out of the grasses, like the grass itself, different than the pollen we get out of flowers?
Absolutely. Pollens come from plants that are entomophilous, the ones that cause allergy, or anemophilous. Anemophilous plants, think of an anemometer, are wind-pollinated, so they don't need insects. That's why there's so much of those pollens that get into the air. Other plants that make flowers are entomophilous, like entomology. They're insect-pollinated. Those pollens tend to be larger and stickier so that the insects will carry it from one to the other. That's why people tend not to be allergic to flowers, because the flowers don't release their pollen very much, but they are allergic to things that don't make flowers, which we tend to call weeds.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the reaction's coming from.
From the pollen.
And it's rare to have
Other thing about the pollen is that it's subjected to a lot of stresses, so over time the pollen grains will break apart into smaller pieces, forming a bioaerosol that's in the air. So even if you don't see large amounts of pollen on a specific day, there's still a tremendous amount of the allergen floating in the air that may be free of the intact pollen grains.
Is the pollen count then very useful for folks who are suffering?
Well, as Mike said earlier, the pollen count tells you what types of things are in the air. People who have had allergy testing know what they're allergic to, and so they can pay attention to what types of things are in the air at specific times, and that tells them that it's time to start taking their medication or see their allergist and get treated. Once the pollen count goes down again, then they know that the all clear has sounded, and they can go back out.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard that thunderstorms are bad for allergies, but doesn't the rain just wash the pollen out of the air then?
Well, it does while it's raining, but what happens is that there is a front, a storm front, a wind front that goes in front of thunderstorms. That seems to blow pollen off of the plants, and it also suspends mold spores into the air. And so you get this huge spike of pollen and mold spores right before thunderstorms. It accounts for something called thunderstorm asthma, so there's actually an epidemic of asthma attacks that are seen in emergency rooms right around the onset of thunderstorms.
Quite interesting. Sounds like you have a very interesting job, Dr. Poirier.
Oh, it's fascinating. We love doing it.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Good luck in the pollen season.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Dr. Jay Portnoy is the immediate past president of the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. He's also chief of the section of allergy, asthma, and immunology at Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, Missouri. Let me reintroduce my other guest, Dr. Kalman Prussin, who is chief of the lymphocyte biology section of the Laboratory of Allergy Allergic Diseases at the NIH, and that's the division, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH. Dr. Michael Kalliner, professor of medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine and director of the Institute for Asthma and Allergy in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Lots of questions still to be asked. Let's go to Lisa from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. I just wanted to say I've been through a lot with allergies, and I've found some things that have really helped me cope with allergies, and I wanted to share it. For a long time, I had crippling allergy symptoms. I was out of work a lot with sinus headaches once a week during the allergy season, which is really about 10 months a year in Savannah. And A couple of years ago, I just got tired of it. I said, I have to try a different approach. I was going through balancing the medicine symptoms versus the allergic reaction. And, you know, I didn't know which was making me sicker, the medications or the allergies at a certain point. And so I said, okay, let's try a different approach. I started a saline rinse. I started going to a chiropractor, and I got off of all of the allergy medicines and started really forcing fluids, really drinking a lot of water. And I have taken those symptoms and knocked very severe allergies back to very minor allergies. And I'm not sure, you know, what in the combination of those things, or possibly growing out of the allergies coincidentally at the same time, but I really don't suffer
That's good to hear.
Anymore.
That's good to hear. Let me get a reaction. Dr. Kalliner, any reaction to that?
Well, I think we've got two very lucky people in the room. You and she should talk, Ira. Share your remedy.
There you go. Well.
All right. Well, and there was one more thing. I have a young son, and I was wondering if there's anything that I can do to help him not develop the type of allergies that I went through for so many years.
Well, I know I made a joke, but the reality is that allergy is an immune response caused by an antibody that's formed against the pollen grain. And that antibody is circulating, it's doing its thing. And chiropractic, which may have a variety of effects, has no influence whatsoever on allergic disease. So that's why I was making a joke about it. I think in terms of your son, he's going to be exposed to airborne allergens. You just cannot live in the United States, especially in a place like Georgia, and not be bathed in allergens.
That's a good point because I want to thanks for calling. I want to make a follow-up point about that, about stories that we've heard. And Kay Halloran, who sent in a tweet on Twitter, says, what about kids growing up in too clean an environment? We've heard about research in the past years about that.
Right. So there's a area of research that's developed what we call the hygiene hypothesis, and these are epidemiologic studies of large groups of people. Some of them have been done in the United States, out of Tucson, some in Europe, and what almost all of them have shown is that at a very young age, from 0 to 1 year of age usually, that if you're exposed to, let's say, dirtier environments, meaning, let's say, for example, daycare or having lots of older siblings, kids that live on farms where the barn is actually attached to the house, have much lower rates of allergy and asthma when they get older.
Mm-hmm.
And this agrees with the general thinking that if you think about our immune systems evolved over the last several million years to be in an environment where there's lots of infectious diseases, and they've grown in a certain equilibrium with that. And so to suddenly change that over just the course of a couple generations to what are very clean environments where we don't have as many infectious diseases is a huge change for the immune system, which it hasn't quite figured out how to cope with.
Mm-hmm.
You think about it, between a quarter and a half of all children would die before adulthood from infectious diseases several hundred years, and certainly in prehistoric times.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Brian from San Mateo. Hi, Brian.
Yes, hi. I have a different type of reaction to allergies. I don't get the runny nose and watery eyes as much, but it really affects my sleep, and I feel really drained during the day. Is that something that you hear much of, or is there a lot of research on that?
I've heard of that one. I've heard of that one.
There's not a lot of research in it, but when we go and do studies of patients, we find that fatigue, in large part because of the allergies and also because of sleep-disordered breathing. So when your nose is congested, you don't breathe well, you snore, and you get a much poorer quality of sleep. So those are the two factors. But even in and of itself, people who have the classic allergy symptoms but sleep okay are fatigued. And so they both combine to make you feel like you feel.
And, of course, if you're taking some of those antihistamines.
The newer antihistamines are largely or completely non-sedating.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. Okay. We've just about run out of time. Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Dr. Kalman Prussen, who is chief of the lymphocyte biology section of the Laboratory of Allergic Diseases and investigator at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in Bethesda. Dr. Michael Kalliner, professor of medicine at George Washington University and also medical director of the Institute for Asthma and Allergy in Chevy Chase. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us, and an allergy-free season to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Easy to you, Ira.
Thanks for all your advice.